sometimes as a member of the cloth. Rabbi David Ben-Dori is the founder and executive director of Pidyon, a Torah-based educational organization dedicated to infusing Jewish souls with spirituality and meaning. He currently teaches the Kosher Kitchen for the Shema Yisrael Torah Network, weekly classes in Sefer HaChinuch and Jewish philosophy, and a daily halacha at the Wall Street Synagogue in downtown Manhattan. Member of Jewish Gen, the largest Jewish genealogical organization in America, and has traced his family history back seven generations to the late 1700s, and has traced his Samicha back through 130 rabbis to Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a joy and a pleasure to welcome to the microphones and telephones of America Armed and Free, Rabbi David Ben-Dori.
Pleasure to be here, Charles. Thanks so much for inviting me to the show.
I'm really glad you could be here. I've been looking forward to this since long before. And let me lay the cards on the table. We have a professional affiliation. I'm the executive director of which Rabbi Ben-Dori is the rabbinical director, JPFO, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. So this is sort of an arm's length interview, if you will.
Arm's length, yet very close.
Yes.
I'm glad you laid that on the table. We should be upfront about it. Don't let anyone think that we're trying to deceive them in some way.
No, you know, it's impossible to do anything without a prejudice. Everyone has some prejudice. Some folks are prejudiced towards the Cubs, some towards the Bears. Everyone has a prejudice, okay? The dishonest thing to say is that you're neutral. I'm not neutral. You're not neutral. I don't know any, but the only people I know that are neutral are floating with their head just at the top of the water. That's neutral. You can't be neutral. What you can do is you can be overt in your bias.
Well, they are neutral. They're neutral. They stay neutral by keeping a mind so open that their brains fall out. That's how they become neutral.
There's a minister at Unity that I knew years ago. No, I didn't go to Unity. But minister I knew from there, his name was Larry Swartz, and Larry said it's wonderful to be spiritual, but not so much so that you become no earthly good.
Very well said.
Right.
Very, very well said.
It's said that you are one of the most unorthodox rabbi in New Jersey. Emes? Truth?
There might be some emes to that. I don't know. I haven't surveyed all of them. What makes me a bit unorthodox is my advocacy of freedom and firearms ownership for Jews. Interestingly enough, it's not the belief that we have a right to firearms ownership, or that we should exercise that right, that makes me unorthodox. It's my vocal stance on it. I find that by and large, the rabbis that speak with me about the subject come to agree with me, but they're not willing to take a public stance on it the way I have. And I guess that if I am the most unorthodox rabbi in New Jersey, that would be what makes me that.
Uh huh. So is it that other rabbis and other Jewish people, other Orthodox people, are afraid to, pardon the pun, come out of the closet about their enjoyment of the right to keep and bear arms?
Well, you know, you just used one of my favorite phrases.
Oh, I did?
I like to say that I'm the only Orthodox rabbi you'll meet who tries to get everybody out of the closet. You know, I'm out of the closet. There have been articles about me in the Jewish newspapers in New Jersey talking about gun ownership and talking about some of what I do. So I'm very much out of the closet. Unfortunately, I'm often alone in Jewish groups, standing there out of the closet. You know, Jews have there's a lot to this. I'm sure as we go on in the interview in our discussion, more and more will come out. But the first piece I'll say is that Jews have a very long history with firearms, and that long history consists of us being at the wrong end of the barrel. And I think all of the Jewish ambivalence to gun ownership starts right there.
Well, but one must take control. You know, to be in charge of life, you got to take control of your own of it. At some point, one might think that the race would have considered grabbing the gun by the other end and using it to its own advantage. What has made us so allergic to firearms as a what's
Boy,
made
that's
Jewish
a great
people?
Great choice of words there, allergic.
Yeah.
I like that very much. You know, so this gets tangled in a lot of issues. This gets tangled in,
of course, it is
issues with Jewish history, issues with Jewish politics in America, the Jewish relationship with the political parties in America. Everything gets intertwined here. Let's start here. I'll just highlight some of the oddities of this ambivalence Jews have. The same American Jews that go to Israel and look with pride at the Israeli army and send their young children to be photographed with the Israeli soldier with the big scary gun, you know, the M16 or whatever, the Uzi, whatever they might be carrying, fully automatic, I might add. But they send their kids over to be photographed, you know, go take a picture with the Israeli soldier, a very common tourist picture. They come home, and they're that same person is anti-gun. And they're anti-gun not because they've thought about the issue, not because they have any personal relationship with firearms, not because they've ever tried them in some way, but because that's how they were raised.
Mm-hmm.
Views of our generation in America, by our generation I mean people who are now raising children. I'll leave my age as vague as that. Jews with school-age kids today, they were raised as products of a Jewish generation that identified very, very strongly with what are known as liberal democratic causes.
Mm-hmm.
And we were brought up and fed that. I grew up in a home where firearms were simply bad. We weren't allowed to play guns. We weren't allowed to play cops and robbers. We weren't allowed to play cowboys and Indians.
I got to tell you, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in a Jewish household, and I was sent to a Jewish day camp, and we had guns there.
Yeah, you're different.
Yeah, I know. Blessed are the cracked, for they shall see the light. But I was raised around it. My father, I've told this story before on the air. I don't want it to be boring to the audience, but it'll be new to you. My father, when I was six, took out his .45 that he had from the Army. He kept it in a zipper bag at my grandfather's house. We'd go to visit on Shabbos, and he'd take out the bag. He'd put the .45 together, and he says, "This is how the gun works." And he says, "Hold it." And I grabbed it. He goes, "No, no, no, you never point that at anyone you don't want to shoot." And that was my first gun lesson on which way to, on safety. And I always remembered it. And then he says, "Here, I'm going to take it apart again." He goes, "You put it together again. When you can put it together by yourself, you can shoot it." He took the box of ammo, left the room, and left me with the gun in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, now you grew up, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in the Midwest. Correct?
Yeah, Chicago. Right in the city of Chicago, right. Along the
Chicago, actually, I would think would be just as bad as, you know, those of us who grew up in the Northeast like I did.
My grandfather was a judge, and he carried a gun all the time he was on the bench. I don't know that it was illegal then. It certainly, you know, a judge was going to get away with anything short of, you know, being drunk and shooting somebody, which my grandfather was never famous for doing. But even today, a judge could probably still get away with carrying in Chicago, but most other people get locked up for it.
Now, were you unusual, Charles, in you know, growing up in that kind of a household?
You know, I know I was the only one that owned a BB gun in my neighborhood. I think.
Tell me how you used to practice. I think in the basement.
Yeah, in my grandfather's house, I had a range in the basement, and I fired thousands and thousands of shots as a child. Before I was 12, I probably fired 20,000 shots.
So, did your friends do things like that?
Well, no. You know, come to think of it, I was the only one, and people kind of never really terribly wanted to go down the basement and shoot my BB gun as much as I wanted to. So I suppose you're right.
Because I know, you know, I mean, here in New Jersey, I grew up here in New Jersey, and you would have been ostracized for that. At least among parents, you know, I have little doubt that my parents would not have let me go play at your house.
You know,
at least if they knew what was going on down in your basement.
Your loss.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I can say you're right. At the time, I didn't know the difference. Hey, uh-huh. You know that in New Jersey now, I just learned this. Cap guns are illegal in New Jersey.
So probably are toy guns, unless they're horribly discolored.
Well, you can still buy those Nerf water guns and water cannons and things.
Uh-huh.
But cap guns, I was shocked. I just found this out, that cap guns are illegal now.
Huh.
I don't even know if I can get one if I have a firearm owner's ID card. I don't know if I can even get one from an FFL.
That would be interesting to stamp a... Well, you know, what you could do, if you want a cap gun, is you could have someone who has a manufacturing license stamp a serial number on a cap gun. They would then be manufacturing a firearm. And then at that point, you could do it through an FFL on a 4473 form. Then it would be.
You know what? I have a good friend here in New Jersey who
mm-hmm.
is a manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I can get him, and I will be the only legal cap gun owner in the entire state.
That's it. And
that could be a claim to fame.
Unfortunately, it could also be a test case in the courts.
I'd rather avoid that if you don't mind.
Yes. Now, I got to tell you, I'll bet that the biggest question on this audience's mind is, why are so many Jewish people so anti-gun when it comes, you know, you've talked about it, about us being on the wrong end. But why is it that it seems that some of the leaders in the anti-freedom movement about guns are Jewish? That, you know, I'm referring to the Schumeroids, such as Feinstein and Boxer and people like Josh Sugarman. Why does it seem to, like, come with the package?
Yeah, you've also got Bloomberg, you've got Soros,
yep.
The list goes on and on.
Right.
Let me start here. While those people do happen to be Jews, they do happen to be Jewish, their actions are not Jewish. Right, so never confuse what the Jewish people do with what Judaism is. So their actions are not Jewish, and I've got a book full of sources to back up that statement. One of the first project I did with Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership was called The Ten Commandments of Self-Defense. I went through 18 sources from the Torah, what's commonly called the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament. Went through 18 sources from there and from rabbinic literature talking about self-defense. And these are sources that effectively form the basis of a Jewish legal perspective on guns, on defensive firearm ownership, and the like. And as part of that project, I've had this standing challenge out there, and I've now been, I've been mailing this DVD. This is a different project, but has gone out to several hundred rabbis all over the country now, and that's an expanding project that I guess we'll talk about it as the hour goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had a challenge out there. If I'm wrong, if this isn't what Judaism says, show me where I'm wrong. Show me the source. I have yet, it's now been several years, not one person has come up with any Jewish source that contradicts a word of what I've said.
It's interesting.
I put that out there because it's so important to realize that what the Schumers are doing, what the Bloombergs are doing, they might be Jews, but what they are doing in this regard is not Jewish.
Interesting. But I'll tell you one thing that is, and that's respecting the sponsors. So hold on for just a little bit.
You're listening to America Armed and Free on KVOI, your high-velocity conduit to freedom. With Charles Heller.
Collectivists believe that the source of human rights is the state. Individualists believe that people come with rights built in. Collectivists believe that human rights are software added to you after you're born by the state. The individualist believes that human rights are hardware, that they're part of you.
Liberty Watch, the hardware manual for your rights, and America Armed and Free, if it has a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade. Sundays, noon to 2, right after the swap shop.
Shouting praise the Lord, we're on a mighty mission. All aboard, we ain't like going fishing. Praise the Lord, and pass the ammunition, and we'll all stay.
I thought that would be particularly appropriate to this interview with Rabbi David Ben-Dori of JPFO and the Rabbinical Director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, and also thegunrabbi.com. Is that where you want people to get in touch with you, find out more about you?
If they're interested in reaching me personally, yes. If they're interested, obviously, in Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, they should go there. But gunrabbi.com is, that's my personal site. Which has at this point a tremendous overlap with JPFO. But of course, JPFO doesn't offer things like firearms training, which I'll do,
mm-hmm.
which I'll do separately.
How's business?
Business is brisk. Business is brisk, I'll tell you. So first of all, your listeners know that the firearms industry, as long as we have a White House that looks, that acts like this one, business is brisk. But in addition to that, a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the economy, which causes people to hunker down. And I'll add to that one more, which is there's a lot of latent anti-Semitism. We see it, for example, the Occupy Wall Street movement is full of anti-Semitism that's just now, I just saw an article on Fox News about it, but among Jews, we've been watching it for some time. It's latent, but it's out there. Jews are always, you know, the first to be blamed for anything that goes wrong. History has taught us that we should be prepared for such things. And so when you've got a rabbi who's willing to stand up and say, I'll help you be prepared, I'll help to give you the information that you need to have if you want to take this seriously, people listen. Having a rabbi speak about these things makes it okay for some people who wouldn't, let's say, talk about such topics in polite company. I'm not sure how to put it. So business is good. Business is good. We've actually got a new range opening here in New Jersey, which is a sign of the thriving Second Amendment community that's growing here behind what some people call the Iron Curtain of New Jersey.
Well, you know, as Robert Heinlein said, an armed community of rabbis is a polite community of rabbis.
Very well said, yes. I'd like to think that a community of rabbis would be polite even without the armed
armament. One hopes. Now, you didn't grow up in the gun culture. I got a caller, Jack, who's holding, so I want to get to him. But you didn't grow up in the gun culture in New Jersey, as you've pointed out. What changed you? Were you bitten by a radioactive spider?
the big eye-opener for me was 9/11. When I saw 9/11, I looked and I said, the terrorism that has been abroad for so long is coming home. And if it's coming home, we better be prepared for it.
And you did literally see it. I mean, you were across the river from...
I was across the street, actually.
Really?
I was across the street from the South Tower.
Wow.
My office was across from the South Tower. From my office window on the 33rd floor, we used to marvel at the window washers that went up and down the World Trade Center.
Did you stay there the whole time it was going on, or did you boogie out when it started happening?
Well, I'll tell you, the first tower was hit, and all the reporting was that it was some sort of accident, which of course I had no reason to believe otherwise. From the vantage point where I was, all that I could see was an explosion in the second tower. I didn't see another plane or know about another plane. I saw an explosion in the second tower. I was with 20 people, and I said, this is a terrorist attack. I'm getting out of here. And they looked at me like I was out of my mind. But at that point, to use your term, I boogied out of there. And so basically I fled from Manhattan. I was in the middle of the Hudson River when the North Tower, when the first tower collapsed. I was in the middle of the Hudson River. The first tower to collapse was the South Tower, I believe, if I remember the history correctly. The second one hit was the first one down. So I was in the middle of the Hudson River, which, for those who don't know, it's an 8-minute ferry ride from Manhattan to New Jersey. That's straight across the Hudson River. So I was 4 minutes out of Manhattan. So 4 minutes prior, I had been standing on a dock that was, my gosh, let's say this, certainly with a rifle, you'd hit bullseyes on the World Trade Center from where I was standing. It was that close.
All right, we're going to go
less than 100 yards.
We're going to go, that's well within the footprint of the collapse pattern, I'm sure.
Oh, very much so. Yes,
all right.
There were people who were standing right where I was who were killed.
All right, stand by. We're going to go to the phones. And, Jack, you've been patiently waiting all this time. Appreciate it. Your comment or question for Rabbi David Ben-Dori.
You know, like you, Charles, I grew up in Chicago. I went to synagogue on Kimball Avenue. And everybody I knew, I think I'm about your age, we all had BB guns. We all had Schwinn bikes with those type of carriers that were either on the front of your back of your bike with like a spring-loaded that you could actually slide your gun under there and ride around the neighborhood with it. And I remember my closest friend broke his collarbone because he had my gun one day, and it started to slip, and he reached for it because he knew what would happen if he let it fall. And he actually, you know, broke his collarbone trying to catch my gun. But, yeah, I grew up, I've told you this, I used to shoot at Gabby Hartnett's.
I
went to camp
on Lincoln Avenue
outside of Chicago. We all shot 22s. And Rabbi, one of my close friends, his father used to be superintendent of Newark schools a long time ago. And they had a summer home in Lake Apatcon, and we used to shoot muskrat there, right from his dock. So something radically changed.
Wait a minute, that's not kosher.
We weren't shooting.
Didn't they ate them?
We were shooting because they were a hazard to when you went swimming, you would fall into, you know, slip in their holes on the beach.
Yeah, you didn't want to practice muskrat love.
No, not at all.
Got it.
But something changed because my kids, obviously grew up with guns, and they both live in the Chicago area. They both moved out of Arizona back to Chicago for jobs, and they have gun safes, and they shoot probably every other week, and they have a place up in Michigan, that a log cabin that they go hunting out of, and I think it's the way you're raised. I never saw any big deal about a gun. It was just part of our life.
Part of America. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rabbi Ben-Dori?
You are, of course, right. It's all about the way you were raised. May I ask, you are, what generation American were you as a Jew? Were your parents immigrants?
No, my grandfather was. My grandfather came from Russia. Very big believer in guns. He also may be part of the... he always had a gun, from what I understood. He used to peddle on Cicero Avenue and then went into the pharmaceutical business and in Prohibition became a bootlegger. And
that's so intriguing. My grandfather was also involved in bootlegging.
Yeah.
Though I'm told he never carried a gun.
Well, half our family carried guns and the other half didn't. Only one of my uncles ended up in prison, not on a guns charge, but someone had to go to jail one time, and he took the fall. But it was never a big deal. There were guns in it. We were in the liquor business. There were guns in our safe. There were guns, and the truck drivers drove around with guns. And in Chicago, you could go to a pawn shop as long as you were 18 and buy a gun.
Till 1968.
Yeah, right. It all changed in 68. And,
right.
And I remember a friend of mine lost their pawn shops, and I got all their guns. But something changed. I think it's screwy.
You were already at least a teenager by 1968. Is that what I gather?
Yes, I was. I was a teenager, we still shot. I lived in a town north of Chicago for years. I had a house there.
Skokie,
Illinois, and I used to shoot at the police station once a week until they discovered asbestos.
Not at the police station, but in the location of the police station. I'm going to take that as meaning.
Yes.
Right.
I'm going to venture to guess. I don't. You know, you say something changed, and there was, of course, the Gun Control Act of 1968. I was not a teenager yet. In fact, I was not a small child yet. So there may be a generational difference, just that 10 or 15 or 20 years can make as a piece of this. Certainly my parents were a product of the 60s. They were not 60s radicals. They were pretty straight-laced, I think. But they certainly saw the civil rights movement and the Democratic Party as representing them. They identified with that, and they identified that as Jewish values. And they identify, to this day, they identify, the gun control values of the Democratic Party as their values, as Jewish values. I don't know how it is that that's come to be congruent, that people think that's Jewish values when it isn't. But, that's the environment that I grew up in, that in my experience, Jews, at least here in the Northeast, grew up in a similar climate.
I'm glad for your organization. I am a member.
Good.
And so are my sons. But I think it's wonderful to have another voice out there. So
beautiful.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And
great.
I wanna,
thanks for calling in. Great talking to you.
And I want to say, folks, if you would like to join, it's jpfo.org. Very reasonable. And we're a 501c3. We do a lot of educational things. One thing I want to get to, and we only have a minute and a half before the end of the break, so maybe we can do this quickly, but some folks have the Sixth Commandment horribly confused. Would you please explain the difference between killing and ratzach, murder?
Sure, sure. So the Sixth Commandment is lo tirzach, which means very, very clearly, do not murder. There is no commandment, do not kill. That's a completely different word in Hebrew, just as it is in English. It would be lo taharog. And believe me, God means what he says and says what he means. So he meant lo tirzach. So murder means exactly what we mean in English when we say murder. It means taking an innocent life for no reason. Killing includes killing in self-defense, which is perfectly permissible in Jewish law. Not only is it permissible, it's actually a mitzvah. It is a commandment that you are to defend your life. And I would summarize that by saying life is a precious gift from God. And if you do not defend your life, you're showing disdain for that gift. We love life as Jews, and part of loving life means considering it precious and defending it. So if someone attacks or threatens, severe violence or some such, you have an obligation, according to Jewish law, to defend against that. And that includes the use of deadly force, obviously if warranted and appropriate. That does not fall under the Sixth Commandment, Lo Tirtach. There's no prohibition on, there's no blanket prohibition on the taking of life in Jewish law.
Perfect timing, as the music is coming up, and that's part of rabbinical training. It's perfect timing for radio commercials. Stand by. And welcome back to America Armed and Free, where we have the joy, pleasure, and honor of having with us Rabbi David Ben-Dori of JPFO, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. He's the rabbinical director, and he's an Orthodox rabbi in New Jersey. And he also has thegunrabbi.com, which is teaching people to use firearms. We're going to go to the phones, and Eb, you're live with Rabbi Ben-Dori. Your comment or question.
Rabbi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Why does a goy like me need to be a member of JPFO and have a rabbi?
So, two great questions. Let's start with this one. Why do you have to have a rabbi? The answer to that
we
is
we all need a rabbi.
Rabbi. Everybody needs a rabbi. I actually have a page on that on my website. The page there tells a story of two friends. I'll paraphrase it a bit. So two friends, not Jewish, and one is going through a divorce and having a very hard time. This friend says to him, you need to go talk to a rabbi, to which he says, what do you mean I need to go talk to a rabbi? I'm not even Jewish. He says, you don't understand. Now, a rabbi's role is to translate thousands of years of Jewish wisdom and tradition into usable, practical lessons for life that we can all use. And so everybody needs a rabbi. You know, there's a saying from the Talmud, which is, we say in America that only a fool fails to learn from his mistakes. So in the Talmud, we say otherwise. We say only a fool fails to learn from someone else's mistakes. Why should I make the mistake when I can learn it from you? So we've got thousands of years of mistakes that the Jewish people have made that you can learn from if you have a rabbi.
Yeah, you know, there's a phrase. There is actually a technical phrase for that. It's called praying retail when you do that.
Praying retail. Uh-huh. As to your first question, why should a goy join Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership? Well, there are a few reasons, from my understanding, that non-Jews join us and that I encourage non-Jews to join us. First of all, we are the most ardent pro-Second Amendment organization you will find. You will not find anyone with a stronger 2A position than we have, and that goes, for all the Second Amendment organizations out there. To be clear, we're an educational organization. We're not a political organization. We do not lobby. We do not get involved in legislation. We're educationally focused, and because of that, we put out educational materials that are extremely, extremely powerful. But in addition to that, I will add, there's a message that we can dare to say that other organizations can't say because we are Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. So, for example, you can't find another organization out there that's got a rabbi acting as spokesperson talking about the mitzvah, the commandment to defend life, talking about the God-given right of gun ownership with sources to back it up as a God-given right. And you can't find another organization out there that is going to say some of the things that we can and do say about the Jewish gun grabbers and anti-gunners. Because if other organizations said them, there would immediately be accusations of anti-Semitism that people will have a very, very hard time leveling against JPFO. So I hope that answers your question with a few good reasons. If you have a follow-on, feel free.
It does. It actually brings me to a third one then. How do I find a pro-gun rabbi?
You can ask us at JPFO, we do know a few. You can contact me at gunrabbi.com and ask me. It depends on where you are, but even more than it depending on where you are and what rabbis are there, it depends on whether or not those rabbis are willing to be public about it. There are far more rabbis who have reached out to me very quietly, privately, don't tell anyone, but I want you to know I support what you're doing. Far more of those than rabbis who are willing to stand up and say, I want you to come speak at my synagogue, or I'm going to stand up and speak about this topic, or some such. So a little bit hard to do, but they are out there.
Rabbi, thank you.
Thank you for your call.
All right, we're going to go to Linda. Linda, you're live on America Armed and Free with Rabbi David Ben-Dori of JPFO, the Rabbinic Director, and also GunRabbi.com.
Hello, guys. Rabbi, congratulations so much for the work that you're doing in this area. I think that it's very, very needed. I'm older than you guys. I'm 60, and I come from a generation where my Jewish ancestors came more in the 1700s and from Spain, and I grew up in Texas, so my experience was growing up on a cattle ranch and an oil lease, and guns were taught to me at a very, very early age. My first gun was at 4 years old, and it was a BB gun. I was taught never to shoot at animals unless I was going to eat it. The keeper of our religious tradition, because there weren't any very many synagogues in the area where I grew up in early 1950s rural Texas, was the grandmothers. So for 30, as recently as 30, 35 years ago, when I was around other Jews that were from the East Coast and I lived on Maine for a while, I just was looked at as a very odd type character. Because of my views on self-defense and the way that I was brought up and taught. So I want to thank you for the work that you're doing in educating the more newly arrived East Coast cousins, which, as far as I'm concerned, they're very newly arrived still from my branch of the family.
Delayed pilgrims.
Yes. So congratulations.
Linda, thank you so much. I really appreciate your call. I appreciate you expressing your support. I will comment that I get emails all the time. They usually come in through JPFO. You know, would they please pass this on to the rabbi with similar expressions? And it's very moving for me to hear it. And
the liberal democratic left wing of the Jewish people. They put me in fear of what they may open themselves up to. So why what you are doing is so important, so that the Holocaust does not happen again.
Yeah, JPFO does have a tendency to put the gunpowder in never again.
Yes.
I will say that, did you know that there is a Texas dialect of Hebrew?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, it's shalom.
Right, I didn't know that.
It's shalom,
y'all.
Shalom, y'all.
Yes.
She got
shalom,
it.
Y'all,
hey,
I know.
Hey, she got the punchline before I did.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Well, Linda, shalom, y'all. That's all I can say.
Yeah. And let's see. Mark, you're live on Liberty Watch with Rabbi David Ben-Dori. Your comment or question?
Yeah, wow. This must be the 44 Magnum Jewish show here today.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Charles and I are longtime cohorts here, and we contaminate each other with ideas of freedom. And real refreshing to hear you, and you are what I would have expected, you know, had I gone through all this. I'm an outside heathen Lutheran, but I have studied this issue just from a personal standpoint of why would this be the way it is. And my conclusion, and I hope you comment on this, is that I see Jewish culture is sort of central authority based, and I feel that maybe that's where the tendency comes from for them to want to latch on to what the central authority believes, which is more control and more authoritarian things versus being a independent self-defense, freedom, non-central control society. So go ahead, and I'm glad to hear you today.
Wow, that's a tough one. I'm not sure I agree. I'll contrast Jewish religious authority with Catholic religious authority. I know a lot less about Lutheran, so I won't even pretend I can comment on that. You know, Catholic religious authority, my understanding is it comes from the Pope and descends downward. The Pope is infallible, very, very centralized power structure. Everything comes down from the top. Judaism has a much more localized structure of religious authority. Every rabbi is the authority in his own community, just outside of the Orthodox world, in his or her own community. And there's much less, while there is something of a hierarchy, that hierarchy is not based on some sort of central authority. It's based on what we call Torah authority, which effectively means there are rabbis in every generation who are recognized for their stature in authoritative learning of Torah law and Jewish tradition, and that's how they achieve authority. It's not that they're appointed to some position. It's that they simply have earned the respect of so many of their colleagues by having so many of their colleagues turn to them with questions that they have, that those rabbis achieve authority may not be the right word, but responsibility for the generation.
I think you're saying it's more of a meritocracy of learning.
It's a meritocracy of learning is a very good way to put it, Charles. Thank you. So I'm not sure I agree with you. Having said that, there is a certain amount of truth in the idea that there are many, many Jews who are looking for to government for the answer, looking to government to solve the problem, if you will.
May I?
Karl Marx did such a thing. Sure, Charles, go ahead.
I call it kibbutz syndrome. They're looking for a collective.
Interesting. Well, as a culture, as a people, we are idealists, that's for sure. And we have an inherent belief in the fundamental goodness of all people, and in a belief in a utopian society that we can build someday. So much of Judaism is focusing on the concept of perfecting the world that we live in, and it's something that human beings can do to perfect the world. So if one projects that desire and that wish onto government, you end up with what you're describing as sort of an authoritarianism, a central control approach to governance.
Or at least a collective one. If it's not centralized, it's at least collectivized.
Mm-hmm.
A local.
So there are
communitarian,
some elements of that.
Communitarianism, in other words. I think of, you know, the people who, you know, you say being idealistic. I think of Anim Amin, I believe. You know, it's the whole spirit of, I believe in this dream of a future, of something in the future. Of course, at this moment, what I believe in non-spiritually is that we're about to run up on a break. And we might as well just start that right now when we're in between callers and in between questions. Mark, do you have a follow-up after this?
I just want to say, I think he cleared that up for me, and I may be more accurate on the Catholicism side than on the Judaism side, but I think he might have something there where it's coming from the thoughts rather than the structure.
Got it. All right. Stamp, see ya.
Thanks for your call, Mark.
Stand by on AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. And we're going to go, we're back in the last segment. If you have a question, please make it very concise at 790-2040 in the Perfection Auto Works Studios. We're going to go, we've got Rabbi Vandori on. And very briefly, what is your mission at JPFO as the Rabbinic Director?
Well, my mission as Rabbinic Director is to influence Jewish opinion in this country. I've done several projects with JPFO toward that end. One of them is a DVD we produced called No Guns for Jews, which documents the use of gun control, disarmament, victim disarmament, as a tool for oppression of the Jewish people, going all the way back from biblical times and coming up through Nazi Germany to modern times, modern Israel. We are at JPFO, one of my big projects is getting that DVD into the hands of every rabbi in the country. I alluded to this earlier. We've gotten it so far into the hands of several hundred Orthodox rabbis in New York, New Jersey. We've hit some in Arizona, some in Florida. We're gradually working our way through the country. We started with the Orthodox world because that's the world that I'm closest to and know best, but we're going to continue outward from there to the non-Orthodox rabbinate in America. And the goal is to get people to actually engage with this issue and think about it, because what I find over and over is that when they engage with the issue and think about it, they realize that everything they were taught were wrong, is simply wrong, and that they're not as anti-gun as they thought they were.
Mm-hmm. Very briefly, why is it that so few folks can pronounce a chuv? Never mind.
You see, one of the secrets to finding out who is a Jew and who isn't is if they can make a proper ch sound in the middle of the word. You know, toach,
toteach.
If they can do that, they might actually be a Jew. If not, they're out.
Yeah, it's a shibboleth.
It's the secret to Jewish survival.
There you go. Ron, your life on America Armed and Free with Rabbi David Ben-Dori. Your comment or question for the rabbi.
Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi David.
Shalom Aleichem. There you go.
Listen, Rabbi, as a Holocaust survivor that spent 4 years in concentration camps, I believe, not only I believe, that we have to be able to defend ourselves in any way, shape, or form. Unfortunately, our younger generation, and even my own generation, became too complacent both in the United States and in Israel when it comes to defending our country, our people. That's item number one. Item number two that I would like to ask you is, where does it say in the Torah, Gmilut Hasidim? It says in the Torah, in our scriptures, it says Gmilut Hasadim. And if we could teach our ultra, ultra Orthodox that Hasadim and Hasidim are not the same thing, that HaTorah Omedet Al Avodah, Al HaTorah Al Avodah Val Gmilut Hasadim. And I know that you understand my meaning.
Yeah, but the rest of us didn't.
I do understand your meaning. I understand it very well. I'll take things in the order you presented them. So first, God bless you. You're a Holocaust survivor. You know, we don't hold a candle to your generation. Tough as nails, what you survived and that you've gone on to build a life. I'm in awe. I had the privilege of teaching an 80-year-old Holocaust survivor to shoot a firearm for the first time. And at the end of the lesson, she looked at me with tears in her eyes, and she said, I won't be afraid to be at home alone anymore. And she thanked me and said, God bless you, Rabbi. I've wanted to learn this for so many years, but I never had a rabbi to teach me. So we need to change people's minds and change their thinking on this, and it goes one person at a time. To go to the Holocaust as an example, if you look at the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, you had a few hundred Jews with a few tens of guns and a few hundred rounds of ammunition. Imagine what would have been if they had had a few hundred guns. They held off the entire German army of 3,000 to 4,000 troops armed with grenade launchers and tanks and machine guns, and they held them off out of the Warsaw Ghetto for weeks, preserving people's lives. Imagine if there had been...
And unfortunately, we forgot about it.
And so that, to me, if you ask me what never again means, it means that we will be armed. That we never again means that it has to have teeth. We have to mean it. As to your other comment, which I think we can be a little more upbeat about, Ron's comment, Ron quoted from Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers, where we learn from Shimon HaTzadik Omer, HaShloshah Devarim HaOlam Omed. Shimon, the righteous, says that the world stands on three things: on Torah, on divine service, and on acts of loving kindness. Torah meaning the study of Jewish law and Jewish tradition. Divine service meaning focusing all of our actions on behaving in a godlike manner in the world and serving God in all that we do. And finally, acts of loving kindness, which is the basis of all civilization. In fact, the Torah, we are told in the Talmud that the Torah begins with an act of loving kindness and ends with an act of loving kindness. The beginning act of loving kindness that God clothed Adam and Eve, and from that we learn that we should provide clothes to those in need, and obviously there are other needs as well. And the final act of kindness in the Torah, that when Moses dies at the end of the book of Devarim, what is it in English? Deuteronomy. At the end of the book of Deuteronomy, God himself buries Moses and teaches us that we should bury the dead as a final act of loving kindness. So yes, Ron, you're right. We need more loving kindness in the world. Unfortunately, we have to juxtapose that with a true stance of never again. But until evil is banished from the world, that is the way the world is that we live in.
Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate your service to the whole community.
Ron, thank you for your call. And
as we say,
Asel Acharav. Preserve you.
Asel Acharav.
Ukne lecha chaver.
Right.
All right. And you thought Too Jewish ended at 10 o'clock, huh? Well, no, it's still on. Of course, that rabbi is a whole bunch different than this one. So that rabbi gave Sandy Frohman a hard time on the radio. Back to America Armed and Free, and Dale, you're live with the rabbi.
Yes, and good afternoon, Rabbi. I this is I'm taking the opportunity to ask you a question that's not quite in the line of what you have been talking about, but in reading the Old Testament, I see, perhaps not in the first five books, but I see references to wearing of sackcloth and ashes, like, you know, in Esther, where Mordecai wore sackcloth and ashes. And I was curious as to where, is this thing a God thing, or was this thing part of the tradition?
There's not a mitzvah, there's not a divine commandment to wear sackcloth and ashes. The wearing of sackcloth and ashes is a sign of mourning or distress. By sackcloth, if people aren't familiar, think of a burlap sack. You see it in the book of Esther, you see it in the book of Jonah. I don't think you see it in the five books of Moses, but that is simply a human expression of mourning.
Well, okay, but then it's sort of a traditional thing as opposed to something God ordered.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your question.
That was a literate question. Not that I expect any.
It was a very highly literate question.
Not that I expect any less from this audience, but as a rabbi, Rabbi Ben-Dori, you deal in reason. How come reason and statistics rarely penetrate the emotional side on the issue of self-defense and on the right to keep and bear arms?
Look, Charles, most of us are not able to put our emotional baggage aside, you know, when we deal with most issues in life. That's the reality. And self-defense requires us to face some real emotional challenges. If you want to take this issue seriously, you have to seriously think about the possibility of someone coming into your house intending to harm you or your family. You have to seriously think about your wife, your sister, your daughter, your mother, alone in a parking lot being attacked by a rapist, and what she needs to do to fight off that attack and to survive. And we don't like to think about those things. They're extremely unpleasant. It's much easier to say guns are evil, get rid of all guns, and all the problems will go away. These attackers can't succeed if they don't have guns, which, of course, is obviously so logically foolish, so illogical and foolish. But it's easier than actually facing our fears, facing the fear of, look, I can tell you, 10 years ago in my community, a very, very close friend of mine came home from synagogue and found his children held at gunpoint in his living room by a house robber in a robbery that had gone awry. That's the reality of the world we live in. We live in a world with some very sick people in it, and what self-defense means, what being prepared for self-defense means, it means actually thinking about such things and how we would handle them. Because, God forbid, we don't want to be in such a situation unprepared.
Right. Rabbi Ben-Dori, we're down to the last 20 seconds. If you'd like to give any websites or any way of anything you'd like to say in the last 20 seconds.
Well, I'd like to invite everyone to come visit us at jpfo.org. That's Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. And if you'd like to visit me personally, you can visit me at gunrabbi.com. Love to hear from you.
All right. And again, that's gunrabbi.com.
Gunrabbi.com.
All right. It's like that ad campaign on doublemyspeed.com. You just have to keep saying it about 30 times very quickly. You're such a joy and a delight.
It's a pleasure being here. Charles, I want to thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
It's really a lot of fun with the hour, and your listeners are terrific. Some great questions, though.
Yeah, they truly are. And you're a real blessing both to JPFO and to the United States. I appreciate you.
Well, let me leave you with a blessing that you should fight the good fight for freedom for all of us.
All right. Enjoy. Good night.